I'm on page 96 of Theosophy. This is the third tape, beginning at the beginning of the last paragraph. Page 96. The region of liking and disliking in the soul world that has been described above as the fourth region imposes special trials on the soul. As long as the soul dwells in the body, it shares all that concerns the body. The inner surge of liking and disliking is bound up with the body. The body causes the soul's feeling of well-being and comfort, dislike and discomfort. During his physical life, man feels that his body is himself. What is called the feeling of self is based upon this fact. And the more people are inclined to be sensuous, the more does their feeling of self take on this character. After death, the body, the object of the feeling of self, is lacking. On this account, the soul, which still retains such a feeling, has the sensation of being emptied out, as it were. A feeling as if it had lost itself overcomes the soul. This continues until it has been recognized that the true human being does not lie in the physical. The impressions made by this fourth region on the soul, accordingly, destroy the illusion of the bodily self. The soul learns to feel this corporeality no longer as an essential reality. It is cured and purified of its attachment to the body. In this way, it has conquered what previously chained it strongly to the physical world, and it can now unfold fully the forces of sympathy that flow outwards. It has, so to speak, broken free from itself, and is ready to pour itself into the common soul world with full sympathy. It should not pass unnoted that the experiences of this region are suffered to an especial degree by suicides. Such a one leaves his physical body in an artificial way, although all the feelings connected with it remain unchanged. In the case of natural death, the decay of the body is accompanied by a partial dying out of the feelings of attachment to it. In the case of suicides, there are, in addition to the torment caused by the feeling of having been suddenly emptied out, the unsatisfied desires and wishes because of which they have deprived themselves of their bodies. The fifth stage of the soul world is that of soul light. In it, sympathy with others has already reached a high degree of importance. Souls are connected with this stage insofar as they did not lose themselves in the satisfaction of lower necessities during their physical lives, but had joy and pleasure in their surroundings. Over-enthusiasm for nature, for example, in that it has borne something of a sensuous character, undergoes purifying here. It is necessary, however, to distinguish clearly this kind of love of nature from the higher living in nature that is of the spiritual kind that seeks for the spirit revealing itself in the things and events of nature. This kind of feeling for nature is one of the things that develop the spirit itself and establishes something permanent in it. One must distinguish, however, between such a feeling for nature and a pleasure in nature that is based on the senses. In regard to this, the soul requires purification, just as well as in regard to other inclinations based on mere physical existence. Many people see a kind of ideal in the arrangements of civilization that serves sensuous well-being, and in a system of education that above all brings about sensuous comfort. One cannot say that they seek to further only their selfish impulses. Their souls are, nevertheless, directed toward the physical world and must be cured of this by the force of sympathy that rules in the fifth region of the soul world and lacks these external means of gratification. Here the soul gradually recognizes that this sympathy must take other directions. These are found in the outpouring of the soul into the soul region, which is brought about by sympathy with the soul surroundings. Those souls also are purified here that mainly seek an enhancement of their sensuous welfare from their religious observances, whether it be that their longing goes out to an earthly or to a heavenly paradise. They indeed find this paradise in the soul land, but only for the purpose of seeing through its worthlessness. These are, of course, merely a few detached examples of purifications that take place in this fifth region. They could be multiplied indefinitely. By means of the sixth region, that of active soul force, the purification of the part of the soul that thirsts for action takes place in souls whose activity does not bear an egotistical character, but springs nevertheless from the sensuous satisfaction that action affords them. Viewed superficially, natures that develop such a desire for action convey the impression of being idealists. They show themselves to be persons capable of self-sacrifice. In a deeper sense, however, the chief thing with them is the enhancement of a sensuous feeling of pleasure. Many artistic natures, and those who give themselves up to scientific activity because it pleases them, belong to this class. These people are bound to the physical world by the belief that art and science exist for the sake of such pleasure. The seventh region, that of the real soul life, frees man from his last inclinations to the sensory physical world. Each preceding region takes up from the soul whatever has affinity with it. The part of the soul still enveloping the spirit is the belief that its activity should be entirely devoted to the physical world. There are highly gifted individuals whose thoughts, however, are occupied with scarcely anything but the occurrences of the physical world. This belief can be called materialistic. It must be destroyed, and this is done in the seventh region. There the souls see that in true reality there exist no objects for materialistic thinking. Like ice in the sun, this belief of the soul melts away. The soul being is now absorbed into its own world. Now free of all fetters, the spirit rises to the regions where it lives entirely in surroundings of its own nature. The soul had completed its previous earthly task, and after death any traces of this task that remained fettering the spirit have dissolved. By overcoming the last trace of the earthly, the soul is itself given back to its own element. One sees from this description that the experiences in the soul world, and also the conditions of soul life after death, take on an ever less repellent character the more a man has stripped off those elements adhering to him from his earthly union with the physical corporeality, and that were directly related to his body. The soul will belong for a longer or shorter time to one or another region according to the conditions created during its physical life. Wherever the soul feels affinity, there it remains until affinity is extinguished. Where no relation exists, it goes on its way without feeling the possible effects. It was intended that only the fundamental characteristics of the soul world and the outstanding features of the life of the soul in this world should be described here. This applies also to the following descriptions of the spirit land. It would exceed the prescribed limits of this book were further descriptions of the characteristics of these higher worlds attempted. The spatial relationships and the time lapses, terms that can only be used by way of comparison because the conditions are quite different there from those obtaining in the physical world, can only be discussed intelligibly when one is prepared to deal with them adequately and in full detail. References of importance in this connection will be found in my occult science in outline. Number 3. The Spirit Land. Before the spirit can be observed on its further pilgrimage, the region it enters must first be examined. It is the world of the spirit. This world is so unlike the physical that all that is said about it will appear fantastic to anyone who is only willing to trust his physical senses. What has already been said in regard to the world of the soul, that is, that we have to use analogies to describe it, also holds good here to a still higher degree. Our language, which for the most part serves only for the realities of the senses, is not richly blessed with expressions applicable directly to the spirit land. It is therefore especially necessary to ask the reader to understand much that is said as an indication, only because everything that is described here is so unlike the physical world that only in this way can it be depicted. The author is ever conscious of how little this account can really resemble the experiences of this region, owing to the imperfection of our language, calculated as it is to be our medium of expression for the physical world. It must above all things be emphasized that this world is woven out of the substance of which human thought consists. The word substance, too, is here used in a far from strict or accurate sense. Thought, however, as it lives in man, is only a shadow picture, a phantom of its true nature. Just as the shadow of an object on the wall is related to the real object that throws this shadow, so is the thought that makes its appearance through a human brain related to the being in the spirit land that corresponds to this thought. Now, when his spiritual sense is awakened, man really perceives this thought being, just as the eye of the senses perceives a table or a chair. He goes about in a region of thought beings. The corporeal eye perceives the lion, and the thinking directed to the sensibly perceptible thinks merely the thought lion as a shadowy picture. The spiritual eye sees in spirit land the thought lion as really and actually as the corporeal eye sees the physical lion. Here we may again refer to the analogy already used regarding the land of the soul. Just as the surroundings of a man born blind and operated upon appear suddenly with the new qualities of color and light, so do the surroundings of the person who learns to use his spiritual eye appear as a new world, the world of living thoughts or spirit beings. In this world there are to be seen first the spiritual archetypes of all things, and beings that are present in the physical and soul worlds. Imagine a painter's picture existing in his mind before it is painted. This gives an analogy to what is meant by the expression archetype. It does not concern us here that the painter has perhaps not had such an archetype in his mind before he paints, and that it only gradually develops and becomes complete during the execution of the picture. In the real world of spirit, there exist such archetypes for all things, and the physical things and beings are copies of these archetypes. It is quite understandable when anyone who only trusts his outer senses denies this archetypal world and holds that archetypes are merely abstractions gained by an intellectual comparison of sense objects. Such a person simply cannot see in this higher world. He knows the thought world only in its shadowy abstraction. He does not know that the person with spiritual vision is as familiar with spirit beings as he himself is with his dog or his cat, and that the archetypal world has a far more intense reality than the world of the physical senses. True, the first look into this spirit land is still more bewildering than the first glimpse into the soul world, because the archetypes in their true form are very unlike their sensory reflections. They are, however, just as unlike their shadows, the abstract thoughts. In the spiritual world, all is in perpetual, mobile activity in the process of ceaseless creating. A state of rest, a remaining in one place, such as we find in the physical world, does not exist here, because the archetypes are creative beings. See Addendum 9. They are the master builders of all that comes into being in the physical and soul worlds. Their forms change rapidly, and in each archetype lies the possibility of assuming myriads of specialized forms. They let the different shapes well up out of them, as it were, and no sooner is one produced than the archetype sets about pouring forth the next one from itself. Moreover, the archetypes stand in more or less intimate relationships to each other. They do not work singly. The one requires the help of the other in its creating. Often innumerable archetypes work together in order that this or that being in the soul or physical world may arise. Besides what is to be perceived by spiritual sight in this spirit land, there is something also experienced that is to be regarded as spiritual hearing. As soon as the clairvoyant rises out of the soul world into the spirit world, the archetypes that are perceptible become sounding as well. This sounding, this emission of a tone, is a purely spiritual process. It must be conceived without any accompanying thought of a physical sound. The observer feels as if he were in an ocean of tones, and in these tones, in this spiritual chiming, the beings of the spirit world express themselves. The primordial laws of their existence, their mutual relationships and affinities, express themselves in the intermingling of these sounds, in their harmonies, melodies, and rhythms. What the intellect perceives in the physical world as law, as idea, reveals itself to the spiritual ear as spiritual music. Hence the Pythagoreans called this perception of the spiritual world the music of the spheres. To the possessor of a spiritual ear, this music of the spheres is not something merely figurative or allegorical, but a spiritual reality, well known to him. If we wish to gain a conception of this spiritual music, however, we must lay aside all ideas of the music of the senses as perceived by the material ear, because in spiritual music we are concerned with a spiritual perception, that is, with perception of a kind that must remain silent to the ear of the senses. In the following descriptions of spiritual reference to the spiritual music in the following descriptions of spirit land, reference to the spiritual music will be omitted for the sake of simplicity. We have only to realize that everything described as picture, as shining with light, is at the same time sounding. Each color, each perception of light represents a spiritual tone, and every combination of colors corresponds with a harmony, a melody. Thus we must hold clearly in mind that even where the sounding prevails, perception by means of the spiritual eye by no means ceases. The sounding is merely added to the shining. Therefore, where archetypes are spoken of in the following pages, the primal tones are to be thought of as also present. Other perceptions make their appearance as well, which by way of comparison may be termed spiritual tasting and the like, but it is not proposed to go into these processes here, since we are concerned with awakening a conception of spirit land through some few isolated modes of perception selected out of the whole. Now it is necessary at the outset to distinguish the different species of archetypes from each other. In spirit land also it is necessary to distinguish between a number of degrees or regions in order to find one's way among them. Here also, as in the soul world, the different regions are not to be thought of as laid one above the other like strata, but as mutually interpenetrating and permeating each other. The first region. This region contains the archetypes of the physical world insofar as it is devoid of life. The archetypes of the minerals and plants are to be found here, but the archetypes of plants are found only to the extent that they are purely physical, that is, insofar as any life content they may possess is disregarded. In the same way we find here the physical forms of the animals and of men. This by no means exhausts all that is to be found in this region, but merely illustrates it by the most obvious examples. This region forms the basic structure of spirit land, can be likened to the solid land masses of the physical earth. It forms the continental masses of spirit land. Its relationship with the physical corporeal world can only be described by means of an illustration. Some idea of it can be gained in the following way. Picture a limited space filled with physical bodies of the most varied kinds. Then think these bodies away, and conceive in their stead hollow spaces having their forms. The intervening spaces that were previously empty must be thought of as filled with the most varied forms, having manifold relationships with the physical bodies spoken of above. In appearance, this is somewhat like the lowest region of the archetypal world. In it, the things and beings that become embodied in the physical world are present as hollow spaces, and in the intervening spaces, the mobile activity of the archetypes and of the spiritual music takes place. During their formation into physical forms, the hollow spaces become, as it were, filled with physical matter. If anyone were to look into space with both physical and spiritual eyes, he would see the physical bodies, and between them the mobile activity of the creative archetypes. The second region. This region of spirit land contains the archetypes of life, but this life forms here a perfect unity. It streams through the world of spirit as a fluid element, like blood, pulsating through everything. It may be likened to the sea and the water systems of the physical earth. Its distribution, however, is more like the distribution of the blood in the animal body than that of the seas and rivers. One could describe this second stage of the spirit land as flowing life composed of thought substance. In this element are the creative primal forces producing everything that appears in physical reality as living beings. Here it becomes evident that all life is a unity, that the life in man is related to the life of all his fellow creatures. The third region. The archetypes of all soul formations must be designated as the third region of the spirit land. Here we find ourselves in a much finer and rarer element than in the first two regions. To use a comparison, it can be called the air or atmosphere of spirit land. Everything that goes on in the souls of both the other worlds, the physical and soul worlds, has here its spiritual counterpart. Here all feelings, sensations, instincts, and passions are again present, but spiritually present. The atmospheric events in this aerial region correspond to the sorrows and joys of the creatures in the other worlds. The longing of the human soul appears here as a gentle zephyr, an outbreak of passion like a stormy blast. He who can visualize what is here under consideration pierces deep into the sighing of every creature if he directs his attention to the matter. We can, for example, speak here of a loud storm with flashing lightning and rolling thunder. If we investigate the matter further, we find that the passions of a battle waged on earth are expressed in spirit land in a storm of spirit beings. The fourth region. The archetypes of the fourth region are not immediately related to the other worlds. They are, in certain respects, beings who govern the archetypes of the three lower regions and mediate their working together. They are, accordingly, occupied with the ordering and grouping of these subordinate archetypes. Therefore, a more comprehensive activity proceeds from this region than the lower ones. The fifth, sixth, and seventh regions. These regions differ essentially from the preceding ones because the beings to be found in them supply the archetypes of the lower regions with the impulses to their activity. In them we find the creative forces of the archetypes themselves. Whoever is able to rise to these regions makes acquaintance with purposes that underlie our world. Footnote. That such a term as purposes can also only be used in the sense of a simile is obviously self-explanatory from what was said above about the difficulties of expressing in language such thoughts as these. The last thing intended is to warm over the old doctrine of purpose. See also Addendum 10. End of footnote. Like living germ points, the archetypes still lie here, ready to assume the most manifold forms of thought beings. If these germ points are projected into the lower regions, they well up, as it were, and manifest themselves in the most varied shapes. The ideas through which this human spirit manifests itself creatively in the physical world are the reflection, the shadow, of these germinal thought beings of the higher spiritual world. The observer with the spiritual ear, who rises from the lower regions of spirit land to these higher regions, becomes aware that sounds and tones are transformed into a spiritual language. He begins to perceive the spiritual word, through which the things and beings no longer make known to him their nature in music alone, but now express it in words. They utter what can be called in spiritual science their eternal names. See Addendum 11. We must visualize these thought germ beings as possessing a composite nature. Only the germ sheath is taken out of the element of the thought world, and this surrounds the true life kernel. With it we have reached the confines of the three worlds, because the kernel has its origin in still higher worlds. When man was described in the preceding pages according to his component parts, this life kernel of his was mentioned, and its components were called life spirit and spirit man. There are similar life kernels for other beings in the cosmos. They originate in higher worlds and are placed in the three that have been described in order to accomplish their tasks in them. The human spirit will now be followed on its further pilgrimage through spirit land between two embodiments or incarnations. While doing this, the conditions and distinguishing characteristics of this land will once more come clearly into view. Number 4. The spirit in spirit land after death. When the human spirit has passed through the world of souls on its way between two incarnations, it enters the land of spirits to remain there until it is ripe for a new bodily existence. One can only understand the meaning of this sojourn in spirit land when one is able to interpret in the right way, the aim and the and end of the pilgrimage of man through his incarnation. While man is incarnated in the physical body, he works and creates in the physical world as a spiritual being. He imprints on the physical forms, on corporeal materials and forces, what his spirit thinks out and develops. As a messenger of the spiritual world, he has, therefore, to embody the spirit in the corporeal world. Only by being embodied, incarnated, can man work in the world of bodies. He must take on the physical body as his tool, so that through the body he can act on other bodies and they on him. What acts through this physical corporeality of man is the spirit. From this spirit flow the purposes, the direction its work is to take in the physical world. Now, as long as the spirit works in the physical body, it cannot as spirit live in its true form. It can, as it were, only shine through the veil of physical existence, because as a matter of fact, the thought life of man really belongs to the spiritual world. As it appears in physical existence, its true form is veiled. It can also be said that the thought life of the physical man is a shadow, a reflection of the true spiritual being to whom it belongs. Thus, during physical life, the spirit working through the physical body interacts with the earthly corporeal world. Although one of the tasks of the human spirit, as long as it proceeds from incarnation to incarnation, is to work upon the physical corporeal world, it could by no means fulfill this task in a proper manner if it lived merely in embodied existence. The purposes and goals of the earthly task are just as little developed and determined within the earthly incarnation as the plan of a house comes into existence on the site where the laborers work. Just as this plan is worked out in the office of the architect, so are the aims and purposes of earthly creative activities worked out and developed in the land of spirits. The spirit of man has to live again and again in this land between two incarnations, in order to be able, equipped with what he takes with him on his departure, to approach the work in the physical life. Just as the architect, without working with brick and mortar, works out the plan of the house in his drafting room in accordance with architectural and other laws, so too does the architect of human creation, the spirit or higher self, develop its capacities and aims in spirit land in accordance with the laws of that land, in order to bring them over into the earthly world. Only when the human spirit sojourns again and again in its own region will it also be able, by means of the physical corporeal instruments, to bring the spirit into the earthly world. On the physical scene of action, man learns to know the qualities and forces of the physical world. During his creative activity, he gathers experiences regarding the demands made by the physical world on anyone wishing to work in it. He learns to know there, as it were, the qualities of the matter in which he wishes to embody his thoughts and ideas. The thoughts and ideas themselves he cannot extract from matter. Thus the physical world is both the scene of his creating and of his learning. In the spirit land, what has been learned is then transformed into living faculties of the spirit. One can carry the above comparison farther in order to make the matter clearer. The architect designs a house. His plans are carried out. In doing this, he gains the most varied experiences. All of these experiences enhance his capacities. When he works out his next design, all these experiences flow into it, and this next design, when compared to the first, is seen to be enriched with all that was learned through the first. It is the same with the successive human lives. In the intervals between incarnations, the spirit lives in its own sphere. It can give itself up entirely to the requirements of the spirit life. Freed from the physical body, it develops itself in every direction and works into this development the fruits of its experiences in former earthly careers. Thus its attention is always directed to the scene of its earthly tasks. Thus it works continually at following the earth in so far as that is its field of action, through its necessary development. It works upon itself in order to be able in each incarnation to carry out its service during that life in accordance with the condition of the earth at that time. This is, of course, only a general outline of successive human lives. Reality will never quite correspond with it, but only to a certain degree. Circumstances may decree that a man's subsequent life be much less perfect than a previous one. But taken as a whole, such irregularities equalize themselves in the succession of lives within definite limits. The development of the spirit in spirit land takes place in consequence of man's entering completely into the life of the various regions of this land. His own life dissolves, as it were, into these regions successively, and he takes on for the time being their characteristics. Through this they penetrate his being with theirs in order that he may be able to work, strengthened by theirs, in his earthly life. In the first region of spirit land, man is surrounded by the spiritual archetypes of earthly things. During life on earth he learns to know only the shadows of these archetypes that he grasps in his thoughts. What is merely thought on the earth is in this region experienced, lived. Man moves among thoughts, but these thoughts are real beings. What he has perceived with his senses during life on earth acts on him now in its thought form. The thought, however, does not appear as the shadow hiding itself behind the things. It is, on the contrary, the life-filled reality producing the things. Man is, as it were, in the thought workshop in which earthly things are formed and fashioned, because in the land of spirit all is vital activity and mobility. Here the thought world is at work as a world of living beings, creative and constructive. We see how what we have experienced during the earthly existence is constructed. Just as in the physical body we experience the things of the senses as reality, so now as spirit we experience the spiritual constructive forces as real. Among the thought beings to be found in spirit land is also the thought of our own physical corporeality. We feel removed from the latter. We feel only the spiritual being as belonging to ourselves. And when we perceive the discarded body as if in memory, no longer as physical but as thought being, then its relation to the external world becomes a matter of direct perception. We learn to look at it as something belonging to the external world, as a member of this external world. We consequently no longer distinguish our own corporeality from the rest of the external world as something more closely related to ourselves. We feel the unity in the whole external world, including our own bodily incarnations. Our own embodiments dissolve here into a unity with the rest of the world. Thus man here looks upon the archetypes of the physical corporeal reality as a unity to which he has belonged himself. He learns therefore gradually to know his relationship, his unity with the surrounding world by observation. He learns to say to it, quote, "What is here spread out around thee? Thou wert that," unquote. This is one of the fundamental thoughts of ancient Indian Vedanta wisdom. The sage acquires, even during his earthly life, what others experience after death, namely the ability to grasp the thought that he himself is related to all things, the thought, "Thou art that." In earthly life, this is an ideal to which the thought life can be devoted. In the land of the spirit, it is an immediate fact, one that grows ever clearer to us through spiritual experience. And man himself comes to know ever more clearly in this land that in his own inner being he belongs to the spirit world. He perceives himself to be a spirit among spirits, a member of the primordial spirits, feeling within himself the word of the primordial spirit. Quote, "I am the primal spirit," unquote. The wisdom of the Vedanta says, "I am Brahman." That is, I belong as a member to the primordial being in whom all things have their origin. We see what is grasped during earthly life as a shadowy thought towards which all wisdom strives. We see what is grasped during earthly life as a shadowy thought towards which all wisdom strives is in spirit land an immediate experience. Indeed, it is only thought during earth life because it is a fact in spiritual existence. Thus man, during spiritual existence, sees as if from outside, from a high watchtower, the relationships and facts in the midst of which he stands during his earthly life. During his life in the lowest region of spirit land, he lives in regard to the earthly relationships immediately connected with physical, corporeal reality. On earth, man is born into a family, a folk. He lives in a certain country. His earthly existence is determined by all these relationships. He finds this or that friend because relationships within the physical world bring it about. He carries on this or that business. All this decides the conditions of his earthly life. All this presents itself to him during his life in the first region of spirit land as living thought being. He lives it all through again in a certain way, but he lives it through from the active spiritual side. The family love he has exercised, the friendship he has produced, become alive and quick from within, and his capacities in this direction are enhanced. That element in the spirit of man that acts as the force of love of family and friend is strengthened. He later enters on his earthly existence again as a more perfect man in these respects. It is to a certain extent the everyday relationships of earth life that ripen as the fruit of this lowest region of spirit land. That element in man which in its interests is wholly absorbed by these everyday relationships will feel itself in affinity with this region for the greater part of its life between two incarnations. We find again in the spiritual world the people with whom we have lived in the physical world. Just as everything loosens and falls away from the soul that was peculiarly its own through the physical body, so also does the bond that in physical life linked soul with soul loosen itself from those conditions that have meaning and effectiveness only in the physical world. Yet all that soul was to soul in physical life is carried over beyond death into the spiritual world. It is natural that words coined for physical conditions can only reproduce inaccurately what takes place in the spiritual world. If this is taken into account, it must be described as quite correct when it is said that those souls that belong together in physical life find each other again in order to continue in a corresponding manner their joint lives in the spiritual world. In the second region, the common life of the earth world flows as thought being, as a fluid element, so to speak, of spirit land. As long as one observes the world during physical embodiment, life appears to be confined within separate living beings. In spirit land, it is liberated from them, and like life blood, flows, as it were, through the whole land. It exists there as the living unity that is present in all things. Of this also, only a reflection appears to man during earthly life, and this reflection expresses itself in every form of reverence that he pays to the whole, to the unity and harmony of the universe. The religious life of man is derived from this reflection. He becomes aware of how far the all-embracing meaning of existence does not lie in what is transitory and separate. He regards the transitory as a similitude, a likeness of an eternal harmonious unity. He looks up to this unity in a mood of reverence and worship. He performs before it religious rites and ceremonies. In spirit land, not the reflection but the real form appears as living thought being. Here man can really join himself to the unity that he has reverenced on earth. The fruits of religious life and all connected with it make their appearance in this region. Man now learns through spiritual experience to recognize that his individual destiny is not to be separated from the community to which he belongs. The capacity to know oneself as a member of a whole develops here. The religious feelings, all that has already during life striven after a pure and noble morality, will draw strength out of this region during a great part of the spiritual life between incarnations, and a man will reincarnate with enhanced capacities in this direction. While in the first region, we are in company of those souls with whom we have been linked by the closest ties of the physical world during the preceding physical life. In the second region, we enter the domain of all those with whom we felt united in a wider sense, that is, through a common reverence, through a common religious confession, and so on. It must be emphasized that the spiritual experiences of the preceding regions continue to persist through the subsequent ones. Thus man is not at all torn away from the ties knitted by family, friendship, and so on, when he enters upon the life of the second and following regions. Moreover, the regions of spirit land do not lie like sections one beside the other. They interpenetrate each other, and man experiences himself in a new region, not because he has externally entered upon it in any form whatever, but because he has attained in himself the inner capacities for now perceiving what he previously lived within, but without perceiving it. The third region of spirit land contains the archetypes of the soul world. All that lives in this world is here present as living thought being. We find in it the archetypes of desires, wishes, and feelings. But here in the spirit world, nothing self-seeking clings to the soul. Just as all life forms a unity in the second region, so in this third region, all longings, wishes, all likes and dislikes form a unity. The desire and wish of others are not separable from my desire and wish. The sensations and feelings of all beings are a common world, enclosing and surrounding everything else, just as the physical atmosphere surrounds the earth. This region is, as it were, the atmosphere or air of spirit land. All that a person has carried out in his life on earth, in the service of the community, in selfless devotion to his fellow men, will bear fruit here, because through his service, through this self-giving, he has lived in a reflection of the third region of spirit land. The great benefactors of the human race, the self-sacrificing natures, those who render great services to communities, have gained their ability to render them in this region, after having acquired for themselves the readiness for a special relation to it during their previous earthly careers. It is evident that the three regions of spirit land just described stand in a certain relation to the worlds below them, to the physical and soul worlds, because they contain the archetypes, the living thought beings, that take up corporeal or soul existence in those worlds. Only the fourth region in the pure spirit land is the spirit, only the fourth region is the pure spirit land. But even this region is not quite that in the fullest sense of the word. It differs from the three lower regions owing to the fact that in them we meet with the archetypes of those physical and soul relations that man finds existing in the physical and soul worlds before he himself begins to participate in them. The circumstances of everyday life link themselves with the things and beings that man finds already present in the world. The transitory things of this world direct his gaze to their eternal, primal foundation, and his fellow creatures also, to whom he selflessly devotes himself, do not own their presence to him. It is, however, through him that there are in the world all the creations of the arts, sciences, engineering, states and governments, in short, all that he has embodied in the world as original creations of his spirit. Without his activity, these could not manifest themselves in the physical world. The archetypes of these purely human creations are in the fourth region of the spirit land. All that we develop during earthly life in the way of scientific discoveries, of artistic ideas and forms, of technical conceptions, bears fruit in this fourth region. It is out of this region, therefore, that artists, scientists, and inventors draw their impulses and enhance their genius during their stay in spirit land, in order during another incarnation to be able to assist in fuller measure the further evolution of human culture. But we must not imagine that this fourth region of spirit land possesses importance only for specially prominent human beings. It has great importance for all men. All that occupies us in our physical life outside the sphere of everyday living, wishing and willing, has its source in this region. If we did not pass through it in the period between death and a new birth, we would in our subsequent life have no interests leading out beyond the narrow circle of our personal life conduct to what is common to all humanity. The end of this side of the tape, I'm on page 121, and it's the beginning of the last paragraph on page 121. I'm still on chapter 3. It's a long, long chapter.